Hello, and welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency, devoted to promoting musicians and authors worldwide. Call us today at 941-877-1552 to start your free publicity evaluation. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Please welcome the host of Interviewing the Legends, music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello once again, everyone. I'm your host, Ray Shasho. Welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends on BBS Radio, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or email us at publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. And by the Rockstar Chronicles, Series 1, my new book, featuring over 45 intimate conversations with the greatest music legends the world will ever know. Available now at bookbaby.com and amazon.com. Well, Matthew and Gunnar Nelson have rare insights into what it takes to earn longevity in the entertainment world. They continue the inspiring story of a most remarkable show business family. Their grandparents, Ozzy and Harriet, achieved immortality with the adventures of Ozzy and Harriet, the longest-running live-action sitcom in television history. Earlier, the couple had enjoyed big band success and had scored a number of number one hits in 1934, long before MTV made twins Matthew and Gunnar pop rock icons. Ozzy Nelson is credited with creating the first conceptual music video for Ricky Nelson's Traveling Man. After the Rain was the debut multi-platinum album by Nelson, and they zoomed to number one with their hit song Can't Live Without Your Love and Affection, which made history, landing America's iconic Nelson family into the Guinness Book of World Records as the only family in entertainment with three successive generations of number one hitmakers. Nelson's After the Rain record and tour became a phenomenon just prior to the rise of grunge, the last major success of the good time rock and roll era. Nelson has had number one, four top tens and five top 40 Billboard Hot 100 singles, plus five number one MTV videos, and has sold over 6.5 million albums worldwide. Every magazine from Rolling Stone to People did cover stories, and Nelson performed on television shows like Late Night with David Letterman and Saturday Night Live. Nelson has always been synonymous with entertainment in America. Matthew and Gunnar follow Ozzy Nelson's vision of embracing connecting with people and audiences through all forms of media. They have been doing television hosting work for VH1 and E! Plus, Gunnar co-hosted Lifetime Radio's nationally syndicated morning show. Nelson has been headlining at major rock festivals around the globe, celebrating their 20th anniversary of After the Rain, touring in China, the UK, and of course the US, where they have also toured extensively with Peter Frampton and Styx. Please welcome American singer, songwriter, musician, who with his twin brother Gunnar Nelson is a member of the multi-platinum selling band Nelson and son of legendary rock and roll singer and pioneer Ricky Nelson, Matthew Nelson. Hello, Matthew.
Hello, how you doing? That was quite a spiel. this is your life, and the only thing that I have to comment on that is I can't believe it. It hasn't been 20 years since our After the Rain record. It's the 30th anniversary.
Oh, wow.
So it means I'm a little bit older. Isn't that great?
That's great. That's wonderful news.
Yeah. Still around. Having a good time, loving making music, and still out there when we get a chance to play and still writing music, which is the most important thing.
My wife and I were huge fans of Ozzy and Harriet. I think we saw every episode when it was featured on the Disney Channel at one time.
Sure.
My father-in-law's mannerisms, who he's not with us anymore, was exactly like Ozzy. I mean, you could have said that was Ozzy's twin. So I really identify with your family a lot.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah, Grandpa Ozzy was just a great guy. I was only 10 when he passed.
But, yeah.
I did get a chance to really know him and hang out with him, and I really knew his heart. And I got to tell you, I never in my life heard more stories, of course, for my dad, but more stories about people that had encounters or worked with him that adored the man so much. You know, he was a really bright guy, brighter than people would ever gave him credit for. I mean, he wrote, produced, edited, directed, starred in all 435 episodes of the show, was a band leader, and had a law degree. So it was, he was just one of those guys, still holds record for the youngest Eagle Scout in Boy Scouts history, you know, back when it meant something. And he just kind of had one of those can-do attitudes. He was a really great guy to learn from.
You know, one of the, I guess, trivia questions was, What was his job actually during, you know, in the show? I thought, was he an insurance agent playing?
he was just Mr. Fall Off the Ladder and Make Harriet Look Good guy. He always said that he was a retired band leader. And, obviously, you know, when the show started, it was 1952, I believe, on television. And it was so new back then that Ozzy honestly thought that they were going to get back out and start singing again. You know, he thought it was kind of an extension of the radio show, and they didn't have pilot TV shows, so they made a film to see if the Nelsons worked on screen called Here Come the Nelsons for Universal, and it was a success. And he always used to joke that he always thought that he was going to get back out on the road and be a singer with his wife, and the show just kept on getting renewed. And then when our dad started singing, he kind of, I think that was his, okay, I guess it's time for me to really, truly live vicariously through my son. And he kind of became one of the first record co-producers. You know, my dad and Ozzy, kind of, we have all the tapes. We can hear all the back and forth in the studio glass. There were no record producers. They made it up as they went along with rock and roll being so new. So it was nice for Grandpa. He never really, you know, when we talked to Grandma Harriet, who I was really close to, mm-hmm. they always thought that music was the through line of the Nelson family. And the irony there is it's America's favorite television family.
It definitely is. I'm kind of friends with the Livingstons, you know, Stanley and Barry from My Three Sons. And, of course, Barry was on many episodes of the show. Got to talk to him. And also, Ray Walker from the Jordanaires used to have some stories about your dad, because he also...
Of course.
Yeah.
Great people all. And the thing that's really neat, you know, sometimes I talk to a lot of people that worked on the show. Of mm-hmm. course, James Burton, I'm in touch with, a great guitar player that played with Elvis and our dad. And
amazing.
A bunch of other people. Emmy Lou. Still talk to him, but also Kent McCord, if you remember Adam 12.
I sure do.
Kent was really probably our father's best friend. And, you know, he was called Kent McWhorter on the television show. And he was going through things and learning how to act. He'd come out of football and whatever. I talked to Kent a lot, and what a sweethearted guy. We got some great stories about stuff that used to happen on and off the set. And, again, it's the same thing. Everybody just has so much love for that family, because it was really, if you think about it, there were 435 episodes of the show on television, more than that on radio, running for 14 years on TV, and they had a really insular kind of group of people. You know, our dad and our family, they were popular, that, you know, it was a different era. Everybody knew where the soundstage was. People could walk right up to them. I never saw our dad or my grandparents ever have, like, celebrity moments.
Right.
It was just a kind of a kinder time, but it's like when our father passed away so young. He was only 45, but people still kind of come up to me and say it was like losing a family member. You
yeah.
know, they say,
yeah.
I remember where I was when the Kennedy thing happened, when we lost Elvis, and of course, lost your father.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really neat that our family had such an impact.
It's true. I was depressed for weeks after your dad passed away, because I was a big Ricky Nelson fan, you know. I think that he was the closest thing to Elvis. You know, he even had that Elvis kind of personality, you know, and the charisma that he had.
Sure, he definitely had the same charisma. The
yeah.
irony there, I think, was that they both were fabulously looking guys. They
right.
oozed the charisma and sexuality and sensuality. But the thing was, Elvis was the quintessential extrovert.
Mm-hmm.
Ricky was an introvert.
Right.
Elvis came at you.
Yep.
Ricky drew you in.
Yeah.
And I think they both really worked. You know, there was a great quote in a show that we put together. It was somebody that said, Elvis turned off a lot of parents. Ricky didn't. Pat Boone turned off a lot of kids. Ricky didn't.
That's true.
So he was just, one of those guys that it was real deal music and all that, just different styles, but they loved each other, my dad and Elvis. Elvis was kind of like his older brother.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, there was only one guy that kind of gave Elvis a run for the money, and it was Ricky Nelson.
It was Ricky, yeah. You know, I couldn't believe how many hits Pat Boone had. I mean, I didn't realize he was that popular back in the day.
Yeah, I know. And, I've met Mr. Boone a few times and stuff like that. I just know that, completely different sensibilities.
Yep.
You know, our dad was a closet greaser. And
right.
The people that knew him, especially with his early music, I mean, the Hollywood rockabilly. His best friends were Gene Vincent and Eddie Cochran.
Yep.
You know, it was a West Coast kind of thing. And Pat Boone didn't figure any of that. They, you know, had real deal rockabilly bands and there were kids and they were making straight up music that, was what kids were into. I mean, Pop really wanted to be Colonel Perkins. That was his hero.
Yep.
And, all his life, he only got to meet him right before he passed away. And, you know, Carl looked at him and said, well, Ricky, it looks like we're the last two rockabillies left. You know, I mean, that was really the heart and soul of our father's music. Even going through, his reimagining and his rebirth as a songwriter and a country rocker with the whole Stone Canyon band thing,
which I
adore. I was there when that happened. Mm-hmm. It was, a really interesting career and I love talking about it just because I'm so proud of him.
I want to talk a little bit about your band. Did your band actually started where you were the lead singer, and then Gunner learned to play the guitar? Is that what happened in the beginning?
Yeah, it really was. I mean, there's some stuff floating around on YouTube. You can see where we were the only unsigned artist to ever sing on Saturday Night Live.
Right.
Way back when.
Yep.
I remember Ron Reagan Jr. was the co-host and stuff. I mean, John Lovitz was in the cast. I remember all that stuff, but I was actually fronting the band. Gunner was playing drums. He was a fabulous drummer. We had gotten booked, actually, when the talent booker for the show bought one of our gigs in Hollywood before our father passed away, and we were really pumped to play the show. And then, of course, the accident happened, and I think, we did a little tribute song on the Billboard Music Award, actually it was the American Music Awards for our dad, and decided that we were going to continue and play the show. And we knew that people were going to look at it going, oh, this is a little bit odd. And we did a fine job, but on the way home, Gunner didn't look right. We're both completely screwed up. I mean, our dad was our best friend, and I have to call it like a football game. It's too personal, but we were supposed to be on the plane with him.
Really?
And, he changed his mind at the last minute, like he had a premonition. And the bottom line was Gunner and I were just not ready. We knew it was going to happen, even though we've been playing since we were six and did the nightclub thing. And it was like Gunner just said, look, Matt, I don't feel good. I got to get my head together. And I said, I kind of do. And he said, I'm coming off the drums and I'm going to learn how to play guitar. And I lost my mind. So, you know, it's like years and years and years of, it wasn't a battered ego of me wanting to front. I just thought, he didn't even play a chord. And he said, I promise you, give me 1 year, and I will not have a guitar in my hand. I'm going to play every day. And by the end of that year, I'm going to be as good as somebody that plays occasionally for 10 years.
That's amazing.
And I didn't really have a choice. And to be honest with you, to his credit, he was correct. And he actually really surprised me. And when we really got into the phases of singing, you know, we were really into songwriting because we knew that we needed to write our own hits. Nobody was going to give them to us. And when we were demoing the songs, I'll never forget that day. There was a song where Gunner, his range seemed to work really well for this song.
Right.
And I had this natural ability to sing harmony above after years and years of me fronting. And all of a sudden, we just looked at each other and went, that's the sound. That's it. You know, we knew that was the quintessential, you know, you can flash through a radio channel and in 5 seconds know that's those guys. And so that's where that sound was born, really.
Now, being, you guys are identical twins, right?
We are.
Yeah. I can identify with that. My dad's an identical twin. I have a granddaughter. They're identical twins. We have a lot of twins in our family as well. But
all right.
Do you guys, the sound being an identical twin, do your voices differ or are they very, very similar, do you think?
I think they're very different.
They're different.
So, for instance, I tend to be able to sing a ballad in a lower register a lot more like my father.
Right.
So, like, when we do, we have a show we put together called Ricky Nelson Remembered, where it's a retrospective on our dad and our memories with him and his songs and his life and stuff, and
right.
I tend to sing those songs. Not that I'm trying to imitate him, it's just that I can sing those songs like that.
Mm-hmm.
Gunnar tends to have a bit more, I call it the enchilada. He's got more of that kind of rock and roll grit to his voice. And I also, funny enough, have that kind of Randy Meisner tenor.
Yep.
Where I can sing the high harmony notes and stuff. And, I get hired to do that a lot on people's records.
Mm-hmm.
So it just kind of developed that way, but you can definitely hear, if we're trying to sing the same song, a real difference in our voices. Here's the weird thing though, as identical twins, if I have to pop a line in a recording and be my brother, I can't be.
Huh.
And the same thing with him. So, when we allow ourselves just to have our own personalities, they're very identifiable, but we can be chameleons too if we have to be. It's happened occasionally.
Yeah. You guys had some issues, with record companies. I know you started out was it Geffen? Geffen Records?
It was Geffen. It was actually DGC. We
okay.
got signed to Geffen, and then right before, you know, they had us on ice for a few years, and, you know, it was a few years of trying to get that deal with John Kolodner there,
right.
Who was a real powerhouse A&R guy. When it came time to release our first album, you know, you have to wait for that release window, and everybody else got priority. They said, we're going to be over this new offshoot label with a whole different staff of people. Now, Geffen was the major player in
yep.
the business at the time. And when they said, oh, we're just going to move you over to our offshoot label with a promotional staff that is new, and I'm thinking, well, we've sealed our fate. Nothing's going to happen. And we thought it was, you know, a death blow to us before we even got out of the gate. There were a lot of false starts, but the reality of it was, you know, everything kind of lined up. We got a chance to host what they call Dial MTV, which is a call-in show
mm-hmm.
on MTV that was TRL or whatever, where they voted in the favorite videos for kids. And it turned out that the people kind of appreciated our hosting, and by the end of the week, they surprised us, and we had the number one video in the country with Love and Affection on its first day. And it wasn't from ads, it was from kids calling in.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
That was a really neat thing. We just kind of were one of those, we were very fortunate to have fans that were,
yep.
that really dug what we were doing.
Do you think it kind of hurt in a way? I guess they didn't really promote, I think that third, was it the third album, Because They Can, wasn't promoted like it should have been? Was that kind of a blow for you guys, or?
Well, no, it wasn't promoted like it should have been. It was not promoted at all. And I'm going to give you a little, you know, a lot of bands say, oh, they didn't promote it. A week before we released the album,
right.
after a couple of years of, you know, agenda change over at Geffen or DGC, you know,
mm-hmm.
Nirvana broke on the label.
Yep.
Anything that wasn't from Seattle was getting, you know, if you weren't Sonic Youth or Nirvana, it wasn't going to happen. And the head of the label at the time, a guy named Robert Smith, and I'm calling him out because I've met a lot of tools in the business, but this guy he has probably failed his way up to running the whole show now, but he caught me in the hall the week before the release of this album. It was called Because They Can't.
Mm-hmm.
It was, technically our third album because the second album we made, Imaginator, a very heavy concept record about the media and its hold over people.
Right.
And we did it just based on our experience. And 30 years later, it's kind of, to say it's pathetic, but we made this great record that was more of a country rock album. And Robert Smith said, hey, listen, I haven't heard any of your music. I know you got the release coming in a week, but I just want you to know that I'm going to do everything I possibly can to kill your record. It's going to get zero support,
that's
no
horrible.
Money, no anything. I just want you to not be surprised. I thought he was joking.
Yeah.
And he said, no, I'm doing you a favor. I said, you understand we all have families and we're artists and we have fans out there that are still there. And he said, doesn't matter. You're not going to get it. That they literally killed our album. And so Gunnar and I went overseas and did some shows and kept it going, but I remember that moment as my vow to do something different, so
mm-hmm.
that's when I formed our own label called Stone Canyon, and we've been releasing our own albums and product and stuff like that to our fans ever since, on our own.
Yeah, I got a quote here from Gunnar I found, saying he was proud of the record. I think it's a great record for what it is, but I was given the mandate by, is it John... Kalidner or Kalidner?
Kolodner.
But you're not allowed to play any crunchy guitar on this record at all. It's got to be acoustic and organic, and that's it. I mean, that's it.
Yep, that's exactly 100% true.
Well, now why is this? Why did he take that stance?
I think it was maybe John Kolodner. He really had something. I mean, he discovered a lot of great bands, and he signed AC/DC originally. Mm-hmm. He put Aerosmith back together. I mean, his track record was amazing. But he's the kind of guy that would say to a songwriter like me, "Hey, there's something wrong with the chorus," and I would say, "Well, can you tell me what it is? What bothers you about the chorus?" And he would say, "I don't know. You're the songwriter. You figure it out." And it was like that. So, you know, it's kind of a mystery to be able to kind of get what he was going for. But I think around that time, he just felt that there was such a backlash on any guitar-oriented, like, you know, again, he had come out of Whitesnake and Aerosmith,
right,
and everything that wasn't, you know, he just knew that we weren't going to be really accepted as a grunge band because we weren't one. We were basically a heavy pop folk kind of thing, and he always saw us as the new Hollies, which is not far off, to be honest with you. And, you know, we were our folkies and California country guys with heavy guitars and the other way around. So I think it was just his way of trying to give us an artistic shot in that climate. And I think, honestly, in hindsight, he meant well. He just didn't say what he meant well.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Because They Can album, we wound up finishing with our friend John Boylan, who had produced our father in the late 60s and actually put the Eagles together to back Linda Ronstadt.
Oh, cool.
And,
yeah,
you know, so he had done Quarter Flash and the first two Boston albums. And he was a very, very well-known producer. But that was his mandate was, you know, no heavy guitar, got to be more kind of like, you know, country folk or whatever. And to be honest with you, we made an amazingly good album, and they had no idea what to do with it. It was right as the Garth Brooks boom was happening, except we were on a pop rock label, and we actually wound up finding our way to Nashville in '95, kind of at the end of that whole Garth thing, with all the songwriters in Nashville that were at the Big Yellow Time saying, you know, what you guys naturally do is exactly where we are. So we kind of never left, really, emotionally. We made a lot of other albums and stuff, but that's kind of it was very close. Like a heavier version of the Stone Canyon Band was kind of where we naturally sit.
You know, with all the country artists today, I mean, I would have thought you guys would have been like at the top of the list, you know, because you guys are so freaking talented. You got the gimmick of being twins, you know, good looking guys and everything. I mean, you beat anything out there country wise today, I think.
Well, I appreciate it. Well, Gunnar and I actually have been in this time finishing up, especially this year, our project called Firstborn Sons, and it actually is a culmination of everything we've learned in Nashville, all the songs we've written, with a focus on kind of like when everybody hopefully goes back to seeing concerts and being around people, which I think there's going to be, if you look at history, kind of like a natural nihilism that's going to happen, and we're going to rebel against the lockdowns and stuff and want to go to see shows. We put together something we call Arena Country, and it's not like a Florida Georgia Line thing where it's, you know, rapid country. It's not what we do. It's like you know, Eagles meets Joe Walsh meets Allman Brothers with hit songs, you know. And I think people that are fans of 80s rock and guitar music plus country music are really gonna like this. And I think it was just a matter of time. I mean, Gunnar and I shot it at country. We got signed to Warner Reprise here. We got signed by three different women at three different labels and shot down without hearing any music at all by three different guys who thought, oh, they're not gonna think it's real. It's like, they didn't even listen to the music. So it's kind of the family tradition, I think, of being underestimated and misunderstood. And it breaks out. It works. So we're looking forward to next year.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think you're going to do well. I really do.
Well, thank you. I think the music is fantastic. We've got a man named Chris Lord Alge, who's kind of my favorite mixer of all time. He's done our singles for Firstborn Sons. And, you know, when people hear it, you know, I remember I played it for our music business attorney. He's been in this business for almost 50 years, one of the top guys. And I don't think he even expected it. We kind of kept it under wraps. We played it for him, a song called Saturday Night. And he listened to it on his headphones. And then he just looked and he said, I'm stunned. I'm staggered by this. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of, you want a reaction like that. You know, it can't just be good. It's got to be undeniably, like, exceptional. Right. And I think we've got it.
You know, it's so hard today. I mean, you know, record companies aren't like what they used to be. You know, there's no A&R guys anymore like there used to be. All they do is kind of push the Katy Perry's and Taylor Swift's, you know, the female solo singers. There's a lot of dancing in the acts now. There's not a lot of bands anymore, which pisses me off.
Well, yeah, it's kind of like that. I mean, what I've seen now is a big to, I mean, the reality of the industry has always been every quarter a major label is going to pick one artist or band to push.
Yeah.
That's who's going to get a nod. We never got that nod. We went through in spite of that. I mean, like we, for instance, 30 years ago, we had the number one record in the country and didn't get any tour support at all from our, we had to finance it through t-shirt sales.
That's
and
crazy.
You do what you got to do, and I wouldn't take it back. However, now it's different than that. It's, you know, are you on American Idol? How many followers do you have on your social media? I mean, it's not even a matter of music or somebody listening to something going, wow, that's just exceptional. I love that. I'm going to take a shot. I want to cultivate it and build it. It just, that doesn't happen really a whole lot anymore. It does with, I guess, reimagining and revitalizing legacy artists, you know, and I guess Gunnar and I fall into that category, but I have a lot of people that come to me and say, hey, I love music and I really want to get something going. And you see that it's a whole different world out there now of, you know, the clicks on your social media is all that matters. Doesn't even have to be good. It just has to kind of be in the lexicon. And it's a little bit more here today, hot tamale. I don't know if they're going to be an awful lot of artists, you know, legacy artists in the future.
I don't think
so. I mean,
no, I agree with you 100%.
Yep, we'll see what happens. I mean, everybody used to say, I saw this great thing with David Bowie. It was an interview, and it was somebody, it was right when the internet was really starting to move. You know, people were really more into downloads and stuff like that, and Napster just happened. And somebody said to him, well, what do you think about the internet as a great way of delivering music? And he said, well, I'll tell you one thing. I am really excited and terrified at the same time.
Yeah.
And he said, well, it's just a way of delivering music. He said, no. This whole thing is a whole lot bigger than you think it is, both good and bad. And he said, we haven't even begun to know what we've let out of the box.
Yeah.
And I think we're kind of living that now. And as cool as it is to be able to have access to a lot of things, you know, there's a lot of artists and music that's getting kind of put down in a search window or kind of excommunicated if they say the wrong thing. And all that stuff is, as an artist, scares the crap out of you.
Yeah.
But all you can do is kind of move forward. And, you know, Gunnar and I have three rules we live by regardless of what happens in the world or with our music. You know, it's number one, be undeniably good. Number two, don't lose your sense of humor because you're going to need it.
Mm-hmm.
That was actually right out of my dad's mouth.
Right.
And number three, don't be a jerk, although you can substitute that last word.
Yeah. And,
you know, and that,
yeah.
That'll do you well.
And don't speak out about politics, which pisses me off. Because, you know, why come out and you know, like, bash somebody in politics? You're going to lose half your audience or even more of your audience. And, you know, Johnny Carson always said that. He said, why should I tell everybody my political views and lose, you know, an audience? It doesn't make any sense.
Well, Grandpa Ozzy used to say the same thing. It's like, yeah. Of course, I have my beliefs both ways, but never bring up religion or politics, because you're going to lose half of your crowd immediately.
Sure. Yeah.
And the whole point of music and entertainment, in my opinion, at its best, is communion and bringing people together, not necessarily segregating. We have enough of that. And, you know, I know, just as a human being, I really could give a crap what the actor says in Hollywood about their politics.
Sure.
You know, I don't care.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like, you know, I hate to say it, there's a little, and again, I have a whole family of actors and stuff. I mean, the only exception I gotta say lately is, you know, my Uncle Mark is doing an amazing job on NCIS, you know?
Right.
And he runs a great, great show. He produces it, he does all that kind of stuff. But he's a very successful man with an incredible reach, and he's extremely careful, and we've talked about it a lot, about, you know, not getting involved in all of that stuff, because you're gonna, somebody, you know, especially nowadays, somebody's offended about everything.
Exactly.
So, you know, he's done a good job about that, but, you know, I just unfortunately saw this really unfortunate article about the band Hanson,
mm-hmm.
canceled by their fans for, really? You know, not doing this or not doing that or whatever. I'm just like, where are we? This is like,
yeah.
Sometimes I feel like I wake up and I'm living in a video game that I can't get out of, that's a cross between a science fiction novel and divorce court. It's bizarre.
It's a Twilight Zone.
It is a Twilight Zone. But, you know, again, I'm one of those people that, in spite of everything that you're seeing, I choose not to live in a perpetual state of fear. And I always have to, you know, listen to my heart and, you know, other things that tell me what's right and wrong. And other than that, you just, you know, take every day as it comes and, you know, try to be the solution and not the problem.
Yeah. You know, we're also proud of your sister, Tracy, man. She's done some amazing things. And of course, you know, what always stands out is that, Seinfeld episode.
I love the Seinfeld episode. Yeah, she's cool. I still talk to Tracy every once in a while. You know, we're, you know, it's been a crazy year for everybody, mm-hmm. you know, this year. And she's living right in the middle of, you know, where I moved from, which is, you know, North Hollywood.
Right.
And I'm living in Tennessee. We couldn't have really, more different areas just from a geographical, point of view and every point of view and stuff. And it's neat to have Tracy over there, somebody I can talk to and stuff. I mean, you know, I'll always have California. You know, I was born and raised there, mm-hmm. you know, kind of back when it was a very different type of, environment and
very
stuff.
Different,
and,
yeah.
I'll always miss my home a little bit because it'll always be a part of that for me, and always miss my family that's still there.
Yep. Well, you know, for the audience that, you know, I want to remind them, Tracy was, I mean, she's done so many roles in television. I mean, the list goes on and on and on, but one of my favorites when she was, George Costanza's, everybody said she looked like Jerry. In
yeah,
episode.
There was that kind of latent, what is George up to? Because he's like, I don't see it. I don't see it. And at the end, she had gotten her hair cut. She looked exactly like
that was funny.
Yeah, that was a great show. She did a great job on School Pegs. If you remember that, mm-hmm. going way back, that TV show was awesome. She was in Down and Out in Beverly Hills
yep.
with Richard Dreyfuss and Bette Midler. And I think like, you know, a jillion Lifetime movies. You know, she's a hard worker. Mm-hmm. She's very good at what she does, and I always feel, you know, I'm always saying my prayers for work, for mm-hmm. especially for women in Hollywood.
Right.
You know, it's just really tough.
Yeah.
You know, it's very, regardless of what they say, it's really dependent on a lot on her age. And, you know, my aunt Pam, Mark's wife, Pam Dauber, she mm-hmm. said, you know, you usually go, you're like, you're the hot babe, and then you go to the hot babe's mom, and then the hot babe's grandma. That's
yeah,
basically
that's true.
How they cast women, and
yeah.
and I think that's unfair. But you know, I got to say that Tracy's a very smart person, mm-hmm. and she makes very, very intelligent choices as an actress.
I got to ask you about your ZZ Top period. You know what I'm talking about?
Which one?
The long beards.
I don't think I ever had a long beard. Gunner did.
Did you both guys have a beard at one time?
No, I actually, that's the one thing is like, I certainly wish that I could grow a great looking beard, but, you know, when I do that, I kind of start looking a little bit like, well, you know, Robert Redford, which isn't so bad, but I'm good with a scruff. I can pull off scruff. I can't really pull off a beard. Gunner actually has a bit of a, kind of a Fu Manchu work in a little
okay.
bit, you know, a little bit. Gunner can look like Buffalo Bill pretty good. He can pull that off, you know. But I never really did that. I mean, I've actually kind of, I had much shorter hair for about 25 years after
right.
The first couple of Nelson albums. I really cut my hair short. And just now kind of I've let it grow a little bit in this kind of era mm-hmm. of why not.
Sure.
And I kind of missed it,
yeah.
to be honest with you.
Yeah, you guys look pretty cool. I mean, you know, the long hair thing, I don't remember look-alike long-haired blondes since Johnny and Edgar Winter.
That's true, and we are, you know, we're closing in on that a little bit. But
yeah.
It's kind of fun that Gunner and I definitely, kind of learned about presenting some sort of a look. You know, our philosophy is, you know, I never wanted to go see a concert and look at somebody that looks, the plumber is there to fix the pipe. You know, I kind of wanted to look like I cared.
Right.
It's funny that you mentioned ZZ Top. I mean, you could say, I'm a big ZZ Top fan. Mm-hmm. I got to fly with Billy Gibbons on a flight. Well, he couldn't have been nicer, more respectful to me. But man, do those guys always look sharp. They just, they're sharp-dressed men.
That's,
you know, they look put together, you know, and I don't think there's anything wrong with having an image. And it's really important, actually, in Europe, where Gunnar and I used to write songs and stuff like that. I mean, we kind of got called out by a couple of people before the first release of After the Rain. You know, like, what are you guys going for look-wise? Is it rock bland? What are you doing? And so we decided to kind of take that lesson and created a look for ourselves. And the philosophy back then was love us or hate us, you're going to know who we were. And boy, did that come true.
Yeah.
You know? And, we, you know, everybody was wearing black leather and stuff, and we went for color. You know, we were kind of like an anti-statement. And
right.
The record company didn't do that. We did that. We were okay with taking that shot, you know, the high boots and the coats and the whole thing. It's like, yeah, we peacocked a little bit.
Sure.
And, but it was okay because, you know, we did stand out, and here we are years later. I'm, like, looking right now at a Milton Bradley puzzle with Gunnar and I looking like hot Swedish chicks. Not so bad.
That's funny. Hot Swedish chicks.
Yeah.
You guys should be big in Sweden, then.
We actually were. You know, we do just fine in Europe. It's funny because we just went over last year. We did a festival. But it was a big hard rock festival. They wanted us to head at one of the nights, you know. And so when you hear about going to England and doing a hard rock festival and Nelson's headlining, you know, the first time out, we had to headline our own shows, and we did very well with it. And it wasn't because we wanted to or an ego thing. It's, again, we were kind of misunderstood, and nobody would take us out with them to open. So that's kind of what we did when we first started. And to get that call last year to headline a festival, we didn't do a whole lot of touring in Europe back then. And I remember we got over there, and it was a really big indoor venue. And we were headlining this night, and all I could say was, it was a flip of what our American audience was. In America, it was all female. I'm talking 99% chicks.
Right.
And got a little bit of shade from the guys, which is okay. We learned how to play instruments. We wanted the chicks. There you go. I have no shame about that. And then to go and play to an audience that is all black t-shirt wearing hard rock fan males.
Yep.
So whichever way they promoted it in England and Europe and also in South America, it was definitely more along the lines of your classic hard rock bands and getting a little bit of kind of hard rock cred that way, which is really cool. I remember sending a video home to the wife. You know, we sold out that venue and stuff, and it was all dudes singing the words back to us, and it's weird having all those guys saying, I can't live without your love and affection, but it was happening. And my wife said, where are the girls? It's all dudes. I said, I know. It's just surreal. So it depends. It's kind of like what happened to our dad in the States. He had a lot of success. The Ozzy and Harriet show, the end of the shows, and it was very, very female-driven and stuff. And in England and Europe, they didn't get the show there. He was just a rock star, and he was considered like Elvis or Jerry Lee or all those people. Completely different perception. So it matters where you go in the world, I guess, and how they promote it.
You know, I can see you guys being huge, like, you know, places like Japan and Europe and Amsterdam and, you know, places like, even, yeah, I mean, even today. You know, I think if you did a tour out there when all this crap is over with, I think you're going to be very successful out there.
I think so, too. I mean, in Japan, for, you know, way back, you know, years ago, they actually had a store that was called Nelson Station. It quite literally was an entire shop dedicated to us.
Really?
And we did commercials over there and toured over there, and we were a kind of a big deal over in Japan. And I've always wanted to go back. It's been like 25 years since I've been there. I think since 95 or whatever. And I love Japan. I had a great time there. And I think going back kind of a little older and, you know, with a killer band and great songs, you know, it's one of my goals. And again, you're right. We'll see what happens with international travel and all this weirdness and all that stuff. I mean, who knows what's going to happen, but I'm excited about the prospect of back out there in other parts of the world.
You know, those guys, they don't forget. You know, they love the blues. They love rock and roll. You know, I think they're a little bit more, I want to say dedicated, I guess, than the Americans are, you know, long lasting, you know, overseas. And that's why there's a lot of rock stars that only perform in Europe. You know, I mean, one is Susie yep. Quattro. She never moved out of England. I'm friends with Susie. I talk to her from time to time. But she's huge over there. You know, she didn't have to come to the States.
You know, there's a lot of, and again, it depends. You know, the way that I look at it, when I, you know, before I knew better, I kind of wanted to, you know, be the biggest band in the world. Now I kind of want to be the biggest band in my world, and I'm okay with that.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And I think that's all right. You know, it's kind of like shoot for the sun. If you land on the moon, you're okay.
Sure.
And, we're doing fine right now, but I mean, I definitely think that if there's any indication of our reception in places like England and stuff, I'd love to spend more time over there. You know, I used to love going to Australia, mm-hmm. but it's so crazy over there right yeah. now with what's going on that that's going to really have to shake itself out. I hope I haven't been to Australia for the last time, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's such a shame because, you know, music just kind of turned off, which, you know, it's bad for everybody because, you know, we all survive on music, you know, that's our, you know.
It really is kind of our little solace in right. the middle of turmoil. Right. I mean, it's like an old friend, you know, it's yep. like having a visit with somebody that makes you feel good. And
mm-hmm.
That's why I love it. I mean, I've been playing a lot. I've been doing a lot of these things called cameos, which, you know, yep. people request me, you know, like doing a shout out song, but I always sing a song on these things. And it's kind of given me a little bit of an ability to connect with people and, you know, hey, can you sing After the Rain and cheer me up?
Mm-hmm.
Sure. You know, not a problem. It's kind of fun to be able to do that. But there's nothing like being in front of a lot of people, bringing people together. And unfortunately, if you think about it, that's probably going to be the last thing that's encouraged.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so we're going to have to see how it is. But, you know, the irony there is I think the world needs music now more than ever before. It needs communion. It needs togetherness. It needs to kind of heal that great divide that media seems to be promoting now. And, you know, it worked when it was at its best in the 60s. Mm-hmm. Hopefully we can all come back together again someday.
I agree 100%. I got to ask you something about your dad. Garden Party, you know, there's always been kind of misconceptions about what that song's about. I heard that the reason that there was booing is because there were some cops that were getting booed, and it wasn't, you know, at your dad, but your dad thought he was being booed at. Is that true, or what was the real story there?
Well, I think the funny part is that counter rumor.
Right.
It was promoted by people that were at the show that felt guilty because they turned on our dad.
Okay.
And the truth was, no, I mean, they turned on our dad.
Oh, they did and turn. They definitely did. Okay.
They definitely did. And
okay.
I think what happened, and even there might even be some truth to both sides of that, because even if there was a little, I mean, we're talking about, this is, you know, Madison Square Garden, the
right.
big hall. So if there were cops in there taking somebody out, you know, okay, you're going to probably get booing from 30 people.
Right.
But it became contagious, and the whole place went up, because he was singing Bob Dylan songs, he had long hair, and he was doing new songs they hadn't heard before, and it was an oldie show. They're expecting to see 50s television black and white Ricky Nelson.
Yeah.
And he was doing something contemporary,
right.
you know, and it was when he went into the Honky Tonk Woman, which he just covered, which was a new Rolling Stone song.
Right.
That's when it started.
Mm.
So, whether it was divine intervention, which I completely believe in, because our dad had spent his entire life being who he thought everybody wanted him to be, and he had just put that band together, really believed in it, and it was kind of like they were shoving it back in his face. That's how he felt.
Right.
But he definitely cut his set short and went backstage, huh. and let's just say this, if that's the truth, then why was it that all of those people were backstage to come and see him and stuff like that? Everybody was too embarrassed to come back and say hi to him.
Yeah.
All the people he said he talked about in the song, you know? And so I talked to him, and I guess that's all that matters is
mm-hmm.
what my dad told me, which is they absolutely turned on me.
Wow.
And he said, and I was 2 weeks later, I was feeling pretty bummed out
mm-hmm.
about it. And he said he got this song that was playing in his head, like it was completely done. And he wrote it down on a piece of paper. You can see on the back of the album now. It's like one piece of legal paper with a coffee cup stain on it. What if he didn't want to get up? He wrote all the way around a piece of paper, and he heard the ending in his head, heard it was like a stereo was playing in his head. And that was what became Garden Party. Yeah. And the chorus of it, you know, oh, right now I've learned my lesson. Well, you can't please everyone, so you got to please yourself. And I guess there's a real power in that, especially from that guy, you know, who was in the States. He was so beautiful and one of the first, you know, what they credited the term teen idol for, even mm-hmm. though he was more than that. You know, he was so misunderstood that he got to a point in his life, I'm so glad he drew that line in a song, saying, well, I'm going to do what I do, and I love it. If you like it, great. If you don't, happy trails.
Yeah.
I'm going to do it anyways. And I think it was one of the coolest comebacks because it was a monster hit song at a time where people had largely forgotten about him as a commercial viability. But I think more than anything, it was a spiritual standing that he had to make, and I'm glad that he made that in his life. I always say after being who everybody wanted him to be, he wanted to let them know who he was, and he got that chance. I mean, for me as a songwriter, I can honestly say that I have a skill set to write songs. I know what I'm doing with it. I've written with lots of people all over the world. I've written hits, all that. But I can still say here after all of these years that it doesn't come from me.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever I create is divine. It comes from somewhere else.
Yeah.
You know, so whether, you know, you believe in God or a God or whatever it is, I'm just telling you from me and my standpoint that it comes from somewhere else. So to me, it's proof more than us. And I think our dad really tapped into that with that song. I'm so proud of him for it.
It was meant to happen. I mean, that whole incident was meant to happen so he can write this song.
Yeah. No accidents, yeah. Right? No accidents. That was definitely made, you know, and still here we are years later talking about it. It was like a legendary moment in rock history. And I'm really glad that our pop got a chance to let everybody know, you know, he wasn't going to be 16 forever.
Yeah. But it always kind of confused me, the lyrics, because I wasn't for sure, you know, why were they booing him? You know what I mean? I kind of thought it was the new songs, but then I heard this story about the cops were arresting somebody and this and that, and so I feel better now. It's all cleared up.
But it was actually simpler than that. If you really want to know the real truth, I mean, the songs were definitely icing on the cake, but the cake was the fact that he came out there with long hair,
right,
and kind of with that kind of country rock cowboy look, and they wanted, honestly, that guy they saw in Ozzy and Harriet.
Yeah.
They grew up singing, you know, poor little fool.
Right.
You know, they wanted that, and they didn't get. They got to get reimaginings of those songs. I mean, at that time, Randy Meisner, who went on to, you know, co-found the Eagles, was in his band, and you know, it was, you know, Tom Brumley on steel guitar. I mean, it was a kind of a contemporary thing for that era, and they really didn't want him, who they thought really symbolized that era that the 60s stole, go up and let everybody know, no, it's okay, the world still is going to move on, even though you don't want it to. It was more of a look thing, he said. It's, you know, the blessing and the curse of being a television guy is that, you know, you had so many critics that didn't want to give him the nod as being the real deal. And you had a lot of his fans that never wanted him to grow up and, like, have a family and grow his hair long. You know, so I think it was kind of that perfect storm of a situation that lent itself to one of the, I think, proclamations in rock history.
Yeah. I thought it was a great transition when he did that. I thought he was cool. I always thought he was cool, whatever he did, you know?
Yeah, he was, and I got to say that no matter what the era, he always cared about everything. He cared about the music. He cared about, he never phoned in a show ever. He did over 300 days on the road every year. I mean, I know, just 'cause he had to. He had kids in public, you know, private school. You know, he had bills to pay and all that stuff. But more than anything, he loved playing for people. And I'll tell you what, 2020 would have really been for him, even though he would have been, you know, 80 years old. Mm-hmm. He absolutely would be out there playing. I'd probably be playing with him. And he wouldn't know what to do with himself because he was really about getting in front of people and performing.
Oh, yeah. He's a pretty good actor too, man. He, you know, I loved Rio Bravo. I mean, that was a great movie.
Still is, man. I come around all the time, and I just,
yeah.
He was so, so cool, you know, and, yeah, Colorado.
Colorado.
Yeah, you know, I always joke and say, I look at all those old pictures from the 1800s, and cowboys didn't look that pretty. But, he still pulled it off, and, you know, what a great film. What a great picture. And, you know, it's not that we have that. I mean, I will say this, when, when you're fortunate enough to be an entertainer and actually mm-hmm. be in motion pictures, the nice thing about that is they keep coming around all the time. And people keep, you know, they can visit with you. Songs, if they're really monster hit songs, are the same way, but, you know, there's something really powerful about being in a really good movie. And he did a great job. And, yeah, I guess that's what it was, too. He really spent an awful lot of time on a soundstage. He was a naturally gifted actor at starting when he was very young. But his heart and soul were in the music. That's what he wanted to do. And it was, you know, arguably a much harder life. You know, but, you know, you're not sequestered in your own little, you know, bedroom on the soundstage and, you know, hey, we need you on set, put on your makeup, whatever. It's not like that when you're on the road. I mean, everything from bad food to bad people to, as we saw, you know, travel dangers and things like that. Bottom line is you have to be willing to do something that you think is bigger than yourself for the people that think need you. And that's what he was about.
How cool is it, though, to, you know, just watch an episode and watch your dad since he was young? You know, you don't have to take videos, you know, you don't have to look for old pictures of them or anything.
No, it's true. I mean, I'll go further than that. You know, I have a 6-year-old little boy. Uh-huh. I named him after my grandfather. So his name is Ozzy, and Ozzy is just the sweetest kid ever, and he's completely been music bug. He plays drums and guitar and sings. He steals my phone and he, quote, writes songs, you know, come and hum something that he's gotten. You know, he's totally bitten by it. Loves classic rock is his thing. And he loves to listen to Grandpa Rick. And if he wants to learn about his family, I put on an episode of the show or yep. play one of my pop songs and
That's
tell
awesome.
A story about it
yep.
or whatever. So we're really, I gotta say, I would give anything to have my dad here for 5 more minutes. I really would.
Yeah.
But, especially now that I have my own kid and wish, you know, always thought him, put him as a silver fox, you know, bouncing my kid on his knee.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the truth is I'm very lucky to have so much documentation.
Sure.
It's a little cold and sterile, but it's something. And, we've been restoring the Ozzy and Harriet show in 4K high def, and
cool.
it's gonna be ready by the end of the year,
right.
For the world. We're gonna release it to everybody and talk about something. I mean, you've never seen it look this good. It's almost creepy. It's almost like, I know it's two dimensional, but it scared me the first time I saw it because it was like they were there. And, I'm really happy about that project for posterity's sake, you know, because in this day and age, once it's out there, it's forever. And I figure that it's time that we give, you know, Ozzy and Harriet and as much as we can as a family's contribution to, America first and the world second.
Mm-hmm. Will they have all the older episodes in color like they did I Love Lucy and Dick Van Dyke, you think?
Well, in 66, the last show, they did it in color.
Right.
And it just didn't have it.
Yeah.
I'm gonna be really honest with you. I mean, we could colorize and we all talked about it. And it's almost like there's a difference between, you know, doing a completely different remix of a master of a song that you like and a remastering job. The difference is final EQ and a polish and the other is a complete redo of it. And, you know, we'll probably do a couple of episodes in color and test them, but from my standpoint, I just don't think it's as charming as mm-hmm. it is in black and white.
Right.
But I know that you have a, you know, generations of people that immediately they see black and white, they go, I'm not watching that. That's way too old school. But they're really missing out because I think there's a real art form. I mean, to this day, I still kind of like the look of a black and white photo more than a color one.
Me too.
But,
yeah.
You know, I think it's kind of like your brain has to kind of fill in the dots a little bit. And so I think we might test it a little bit, but as of now, we really don't have any plans of, like, say, colorizing the entire thing. We're not going to do the whole Ted Turner thing,
mm-hmm.
you know. I just think it something gets lost in the translation to me.
It's funny. A lot of the young kids that have seen I Love Lucy colorized, they had no idea Ray Hur was red.
right? I know. It's very weird. It's
yeah.
like a lot of people said, it, not so much with our family, you know, I mean, you know, our pop did have really dark hair,
mm-hmm.
and everybody kind of looked the way that they did, and
yep.
it worked okay. It's just, I think, when you think about the timing of things, it was just time to move on. You know, it was 435 episodes is an awful lot of episodes, and everybody really did. It's double what most shows do mm-hmm. in the same amount of time, and I don't think there are any live-action sitcoms that have gone that long. But it was just time to move forward, and
mm-hmm.
the world has already done that. I mean, they wound up leaving the soundstage right in the middle of the, you know, like for the Summer of Love.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, wow.
Yep.
When you're on a soundstage, it's really easy to kind of stay frozen in that. happened a little bit. I mean, Dad was a rock and roller, but always had to come back and put the sweater on Monday. And it's really the truth. Got a letter from ABC from 1958 or 57, and it was, "Hey, congratulations on Ricky's success as a singer. We heard that he's been leaving for the whole time, and just wanted to let you know we wish him nothing but success. But if he leaves, we're canceling the show. Thank you. Have a nice day." And so it was, you know, here you are. You're 17, 18 years old, and you're faced with, okay, do I follow my own path, and this is what I want to do, or do I allow them to fire my parents and the 30 people that work on the show for the last 10 years? And, you know, he made some sacrifices too. I applaud him for that. And I'm really glad that he had a kind of a phase after that. He really got to, you know, he didn't sell as many, you know, he didn't sell half a billion records with a Stone Canyon band, but at least he had that moment, those years where it was his songs and his vision, and you know, he was a man's man and stood up and did that. And there weren't a whole lot of people from that era that really did that. Mm-hmm. If you think about it, you know,
that's
made
true.
That kind of a definitive,
yeah,
you know, rebirth with her art.
Yeah, I mean, him and Elvis pretty much from the 50s, you know, that's about it.
And Elvis pretty much had the 69 comeback special, and then he went to Vegas.
Yep.
You know, and Pop was offered a huge deal in Las Vegas and turned it down.
Really?
He turned it down. He said, look, you know, the first thing was, as I said, he was really close to Elvis, and he went to go see Elvis a few months before he passed away.
Right.
As his guest. And I talked to the band that was with him there. You know, they're playing kind of in town, and they couldn't find my dad. They found him on the loading dock with a cigarette in his hand, crying. And he said, he looked at everybody and he just said, "Guys, don't ever let it happen to me. Please, God, don't ever let them do that to me."
Right.
You know, I mean, it was hard. Really, it was impossible. He couldn't watch it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, and you have to admit, it was hard to watch.
It was.
And
yeah.
You know, Elvis will always be the king. I have nothing but respect, and I'm an Elvis fan and stuff. But you gotta, you know, as just a man, like just talking to you right now, you know, somebody should have just grabbed and said, "Dude, what are you doing?"
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So.
The Memphis Mafia just kind of hanging on with him. You know, just I don't know if they're a good thing or a bad thing. You know, I really don't.
Right. You know. You know, our dad till the end, and maybe it was, I don't know, I heard about the money that they offered him to do in Vegas, and it was turned down, and it would have been the answer to any kind of financial issue. But, you know, I guess whether or not you look at it, either to his salvation or his detriment, he turned it down.
Yeah, he would have been great. He would have been great in Vegas, you know?
I'm sorry, what was that?
He would have been he would have been fantastic in Vegas, you know?
He would have. He just, you know, Vegas back then in the 70s was really, you know, he called them fans and feathers, you know, and he just couldn't do it. He was kind of milquetoasting down what he loved about music in general. And I don't know, you know, again, I was just a kid. If I were older, I probably would, and you know, Vegas, again, super different in the 70s than what everybody, you know, what it became, but you know, this juggernaut of kinds of tech and all that stuff. I mean, it just wasn't the right time, and I kind of, looking back on it now, I kind of get it. You know, it had a stigma, a real stigma. And Elvis could pull it off because he was the king, and the colonel had him set up there at the International, and it was basically, you know, Vegas was Elvis' town. And when he was, you know, part of it too was when he was offered the job, it was right after Elvis had passed away. And he just said, I can't do that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm for a lot of reasons, you know, for spiritual reasons and for, you know, every reason you could, he just said, the money's not worth it. I know for me, it would end all my problems and it'd be great. And it's not really, you just show up, you play a show and go back to your hotel room. But, you know, think about that. You know, that also has its problems too. You know, it's like the Groundhog Day thing for years. That can, I'd love to talk to some people that have been in theaters there for that long to talk about how they keep their sanity, you know?
Mm-hmm. You know, man, actually, you and Gunner would be good in Vegas. You know that?
It's interesting. People have talked to us about it, and I don't know. I mean, we've played in Vegas at certain places or whatever, but, you know, everybody there now is all about production shows.
Right.
You know?
Well, you can do that.
Like, we can do it. You know, yeah. it's like you see these presentations and you talk to them and then they're like, and this is where the lions come in. Like, what? You what? So, I don't know. You know, you never say never, but, you know, I mean, Gunnar and I had an idea. We had a Christmas hit with a song we wrote called This Christmas a couple of years ago.
Right.
And we did a double duet with our friends Carney and Buddy Wilson. You know, Brian Wilson's kids from Wilson Phillips.
Sure.
And it was kind of basically a new Mamas and the Papas, what we put together with them. And our singing together was, and we looked great together, and it was highbrow and upscale and really awesome, and they're beautiful ladies and really fun, and we thought, well, this is something that we could put together in, you know, one of the bigger lounges in Vegas and have a great time, you know? And I'm never saying never, it's just that they're very busy ladies, and Gunnar and I kind of have a different, or we used to, especially when we were touring a lot, you know, Gunnar and I, we played a lot. Mm-hmm. We toured a lot. We were doing, you know, 150, 200 shows a year up until this COVID thing. So,
yeah.
And they kind of don't. You know, they stay home with their families and stuff like that. So, I'm never going to say never, but that's probably how I would do something if I had, you know, a magic wand is do something where we could put together a really fun, just kind of visit with our friends review and kind of have a little bit of that, that rock and roll legacy thing going in a fun way. You know, I think that would be kind of a neat thing, and frankly, I'd pay to see that show. You know?
There's also Branson. Have you played Branson?
Yeah, I've played Branson before a couple of times, and again, we faced kind of what our dad faced in Vegas. You know, there was really no Branson when our dad was around, but it's a similar thing, because there's kind of a little bit of a, this is what is expected in a Branson show kind of thing, and yeah, I guess we could, you know, change stuff around to kind of fit that idea of what the show is, but it really just depends on whether or not you feel authentic doing that. And I'm not looking down. I mean, we had really great show success there, but we just did our show.
Yeah.
But if you planned it there, they kind of want you to do more of, again, kind of a Branson production kind of thing. And,
right.
You know, I still think that Gunnar and I right now, especially with our First Sons project, we're just not, as much as we, you know, everybody has, you know, you got to make a living and all that kind of stuff, but we're just not done.
Yeah.
You know, we're not finished yet. And the one thing I got to say about what we've done up until this COVID era is every day is different. Even if we play the same venue, we're coming back at a different time. We've had to travel there. We've had life experience. It's a different crowd. Every day feels like an adventure to me, you know, and I love that feeling of, like, you know, waking up in the morning and, you know, saying, all right, God, what do you got for me today? Bring it on. You know, I love that. And I think that just kind of planting myself someplace for too long. I mean, when I have done, like, say, you know, a couple of weeks on a cruise ship, for instance. And I got to tell you, I kind of hate it.
Really?
You know, I've done it enough now to where, you know, there were reasons why we did them for a while and stuff, and we knew some people at Royal Caribbean, and the shows were always great, and, you know, it's a captive audience that doesn't pay, and, you know, people were impressed, and it was fun and great and stuff, and it was just kind of like feeling like, you know, Dance Monkey. You know, it's kind of what it felt like a little bit too much. And so I kind of just don't want to do a lot of stuff that makes me feel like that.
Yeah. Well, you actually got... You have a cruise scheduled, right? In next year, in October?
That's different. That's like a one-off kind of thing, and I love that. I'm talking more of like you're a semi-contract player, you know, where you're out for 2 or 3 weeks and you're doing 2 shows a week and staying on there. It's kind of like being in the Navy. This is different. That's the thing you're talking about is like we have like the old cruise. We've done,
the Malt Shop,
you know, we've done Hard Rock cruises, stuff like that.
Right.
And we like that because that's more, I look at that more as like an extended, you know, gig. It's like one show, you just happen to be out for a few days. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you can visit with people. So I like those. I just don't like the whole thing where, you know, you're on there for 2 or 3, we've been on like 4 cruises in a row, and that's just like, okay, I've been around the Caribbean, I want to go home. You
know? That's funny. Well, let's see, you're working, you said you had a new album coming out?
Yeah, we actually do.
Okay.
It's called Firstborn Sons.
All right.
And it's going to be out at the beginning of next year, and it's a country rock project. We We also have a definitive Nelson greatest hits coming out next year.
Okay.
Universal.
Awesome.
We have, I think, another album that we haven't released yet that Universal wants to release at the end of 2021. And I think we have three different releases on Universal. That's basically who wound up with our label, Geffen.
Mm-hmm.
And we're excited about that. We're excited about kind of renewing an interest in our legacy stuff that we've done and kind of moving forward with something new.
There's also a remaster of After the Rain, correct? Celebrating the 1990 multi-platinum debut masterpiece.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, went in and got a chance to remaster the album with a great engineer at the Capitol Tower.
Good.
And it sounds brilliant. It's so much better than it was just because it's 30 years later. Analog to digital technology has made, you know, huge advances, mm-hmm. and it just sounds, you know, like the big analog tapes did in the studio when we made it that got lost in that translation just due to technology.
Yeah.
And I'm so proud of it. We actually even released it on a 180 gram audiophile vinyl release. And now when you turn on anything on the radio or whatever, hopefully they service it enough that it's those new masters that people are hearing of. Love and Affection, After the Rain, More Than Ever, and Only Time Will Tell.
Excellent. And of course, your last release was Peace Out. That's also available. You can buy that on Amazon or probably on your website as well.
Yeah.
Yep.
You can definitely find that. I think the best way, we're all over the internet. We're not hard to find at all. One thing that I've been doing, I've gotten so many people asking, hey, can we buy some t-shirts or whatever? Mm-hmm. So we've got some nostalgia shirts, you know, kind of going back 30 years ago that we're reissuing online. That's going to be launched, I believe, this week. And also some new designs, and then with our other projects, I mean, I get a chance to oversee, you know, Ricky Nelson, Ozzy and Harriet, mm-hmm. and Firstborn Sons, as far as all that stuff is concerned. So, for anybody that wants to kind of go down the Nelson rabbit hole, we got plenty for you to look at.
Yep, www.matthewandgunnernelson.com. That's your website.
Nice and short, exactly.
Yep. And of course, you're on Facebook, yes. Instagram, and YouTube, and I'm going to share those links as well with everybody.
Well, thank you very much.
Awesome. Matt, I want to thank you, man, for being on the show today. It's been a pleasure. We'll follow up with you after the show, after the new album's out.
Oh, great. Fantastic.
Sometime first quarter.
You'll be the first to get it.
Yeah, I'd love to hear it. I'm looking forward to it. All the great success to you and your two brothers. Your other brother also sings, right?
I haven't heard a whole lot from him in a long time. He's just kind of going underground. He does more of a kind of an alternative rock kind of thing when he sings, but he's very talented.
Yep. I mean, what a talented family you guys have had. Oh, man. I wish I could have just a piece of that.
Well, we're really lucky, and it always makes for interesting Christmas dinners, that's for sure.
Definitely, you know? Definitely. Well, we love you guys.
Thank you.
Love the legacy of the Nelsons. And, you know, take care out there. Be safe.
Oh, you got it. And you too. And we'll definitely catch y'all when the dust settles a little bit. We'll get out there and play some live music for everybody.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Matt.
Thank you so much. Take care.
All right. You too. Bye-bye.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com, specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Tune in to Interviewing the Legends every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time on PBS Radio, Station 1.